Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 6th of May, and coming up on the program, the impact if Shell decides to leave South Africa. A new election row over the DA's ad showing a burning flag. Will Jacob Zuma appear for his ANC disciplinary hearing tomorrow? Why shared home buying is a growing new trend, and the Eastern Cape is set to become the country's cannabis capital. The ANC's National Disciplinary Committee wants former President Jacob Zuma to appear for his disciplinary hearing tomorrow. The former party leader faces two charges. One is about collaborating with a rival party and then joining or supporting the MK party, of which I guess you could say he is the de facto leader. The big question, of course, will he show up? I'm in conversation now with political commentator Dr. Ongama Mtimka. Doctor, good afternoon to you and welcome. Do you think he will turn up? I guess he's got something to prove.
So he has fled the Luthuli House roost, but what's happened is that the Mkhonto weSizwe threatened that they would gather outside Luthuli House. And as I remember yesterday, it was announced that the top seven has requested that appearance tomorrow be put in abeyance until after the elections out of safety concerns. And I think that that's a good call that the top seven has made, because any gathering outside Luthuli House was bound to trigger some violent altercations between the two groups that would gather outside there. We were already seeing people from the ANC saying they are going to go there to defend Luthuli House, as Mkhonto weSizwe was saying they're going to appear there as a show of support for former President Zuma.
Whichever time this does go ahead, what is the ultimate motivation as far as the ruling party is concerned? Is it revenge? Is the ultimate goal expulsion?
They all know that Zuma has left. I think that they want closure. On one level, some within the ANC have seen the leaders to be timid in relation to how they are handling Zuma. But also, those who are acting in the leadership here are mindful of who they are dealing with. Zuma, the only reason why he announced that he'll be campaigning for Mkhonto weSizwe, but didn't announce a departure, was he wanted to frustrate the ANC enough to be embroiled in exactly this kind of self-doubting, half-hearted approach to how it is dealing with them. But I think it's the correct approach, because he does need to be handled with care, because he can turn around and litigate should the ANC not follow its own processes. So I think that this is just an attempt to it's all formalities, as it were. They're trying to make sure that they get rid of him eventually, as he has left, but do so in ways that follow the procedures of the party.
We're exactly 3 weeks away from the election at this point, and given where we are with campaigning, do you think the ANC is becoming increasingly worried about MK?
They are, if we look at the deployment of senior NEC members in KZN this week. It all shows that they are pulling out all stops to ensure that their campaign gives them the best that they can get. And so they are certainly worried about MK.
And Are we now seeing the possibility again, if you look at the opinion polls, where the party, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, but perhaps even on a national stage to a lesser extension, could now become a kingmaker?
MK Party will be important, but not the kingmaker. I think that those who are bullish about its outcomes, both in terms of polls and also opinion makers, are not factoring in what happens in the rest of the country. Yes, KZN and Gauteng are important in terms of the share of votes for any of the parties, but I think that there's a tendency to assume or overemphasize how likely they are going to succeed. I mean, if you look at the by-election outcomes, it shows that MK's prospects are a lot more mixed than the polls have shown us.
I am going to leave it there. Political writer and commentator Dr. Ongama Mtimka, thank you very much for joining me on today's edition of MoneyWeb at Midday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Well, let's turn our attention now to Shell, which has been operating in South Africa for over 100 years. And you might have read at the weekend that it is on the verge of exiting the country, reportedly because of a fallout with its longtime BEE partner, the Tebi Investment Corporation. I'm joined now by political and economic commentator Kai Sitoli. And Kai, first up then, how are you assessing the state of affairs?
Well, I think the first problem is that, unfortunately, due to a problem of timing, there's a conflation of issues. And what that means is that the fallout or the dispute between Tebe and Shell has actually been going on for the better part of the past 2 years. And at the heart of the dispute is the fact that Tebe notified Shell that it wanted to exercise its rights to sell some of its shareholding. It is currently a 28% shareholder in a part of the Shell business. And when they said they wanted to activate that clause of selling a part of the shareholding, the agreement that was signed many years ago says that, well, you simply need to get a valuation of that stake and then we can talk. What Shell did is that it provided information to Tebe, which was to be used as the basis for the valuation. Tebe then came back and said, well, based on this information, this is how much the stake is worth, only for Shell to turn around and say, well, actually, the information that we gave you to actually value that stake is no longer relevant. It's outdated information. Here's new information. And the new information came back with a materially different number. So that's been the heart of the dispute for the past 2 years, where there isn't an agreement on what the value of Tebe's stake in this business is. The question of Shell exiting the South African business is a completely new story that unfortunately emerged whilst there was still this deadlock or this gridlock on the BE stake. So now suddenly sounds like they're related, but they're actually not.
How do you think this is going to culminate then?
So I think obviously in relation to the resolution around Tebe's involvement in the Shell business, the problem, Jeremy, is that the agreement made provision for the big four auditing firms to be the ones that get tasked to do the valuation of the stake. And unfortunately, as it turns out, all four auditing firms are actually conflicted in one way or another. So we actually cannot find one of the big four auditing firms to do a valuation that both parties are willing to accept. So my understanding is that that has now obviously led to a process of arbitration where somebody has to step in and say, well, if these four cannot do it, who can? And that's how that part is going to get resolved. The secondary question of whether actually Shell wants to remain invested in the South African value chain as it currently is probably an issue relating to how the refineries business in particular in South Africa has been affected over the past couple of years. I think you'll remember what we heard about the refineries down in the coast that actually cannot be kept going on the basis that no one is willing to put up the cash and the resources. And I think it's a bigger South African problem where we have to evaluate whether we actually need to do something different in managing those particular assets so that companies like Shell and other investors that are already part of the South African petroleum ecosystem can remain invested. And at this stage, it's not very clear who's going to be the big, you know, the big voices in the room that get us a decision that moves us forward.
Would it be in both parties' interests to try and resolve this issue, or better that they walk away?
I think it's in everybody's interest that we see a resolution in this. And obviously, Shell's business is the type of business that would like to remain in invested in the South African value chain across all its levers. So it's not the type of decision that even the asset allocators or the capital allocators of Shell will take lightly. But obviously, they have evaluated what their spectrum of possibilities are, and they've decided that a part of the South African business probably isn't as attractive as it used to be. So therefore, they're happy to exit that part of the business. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that people are going to stop using those products overnight. So it's simply a matter of if they do put up those assets for sale, who is going to be the one that takes them up, and whether they can run them efficiently enough for them to believe that it is worth directing capital towards acquisition of those assets. So if it does materialize, it will simply be a matter of somebody has to step up and actually take over those assets in order to keep them going. South Africa's appetite for the consumption of those products is going to remain regardless of who's in charge of those particular assets.
Is there somebody waiting in the wings in that respect?
It's capitalism 101. There's always somebody waiting in the wings. And obviously, it will be interesting to see if even some of the bigger BEE players, some of the bigger empowerment partners, then see this as an opportunity to tap into what may well turn out to be a lucrative asset. And the reason we say may well turn out to be a lucrative asset is that, unfortunately, when you have one side of the conversation that says that a 28% stake within this business is useless, you're kind of making it very difficult for anyone who wants to buy the remaining business, whether it's 72%, whether it's the entire 100%. To then believe they should be paying a lot more for it. So it's not very clear what Shell's big PR strategy is in this communication, because if you are going to tell us that the stake, that the 28% stake that Tebe owns is worthless, you're kind of telling everybody that, well, the rest of the business isn't worth much value unless there's some complexities that we are not aware of. So it's going to be an interesting one to observe over the next few months as Shell essentially tries to explain how one other part of the business is worthless and yet the rest of the business should be lucrative enough to someone for someone to snap it up.
That's interesting, because it is a valuable brand. It's a well-recognized brand in South Africa, but globally it has had environmental issues, hasn't it?
I think all of these players, obviously, are struggling with the question of how they maintain their capacity to retain their business models as they are, and also be responsive to what has obviously been the big demand that we've seen over the past couple of decades for companies to be a bit more responsive to responding to the issues and the risks that we've seen emerging, particularly in relation to climate change. So it's not a problem that's unique to Shell. What is of interest is that every single business is obviously figuring out how to best manage that particular question around the transition and balancing its portfolio essentially to ensure that, well, even if investors and stakeholders say, but you have quite deep exposure in the fossil fuel industry, they can say, but actually the rest of our portfolio is green enough for us to be able to say that we are actually executing our business model with some level of responsibility. So it's actually a universal problem that all companies in the mold of Shell are actually dealing with.
Kaya Sitoli, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, I want to stay with party politics, and the Democratic Alliance has released its election advert, and it's causing something of a fuss. Their visual showing the burning of the South African flag. So while it might have shock value, it certainly has caused sharp debate. The question, of course, is what kind of damage could this do to the party if the commentary is overwhelmingly negative, particularly, as I mentioned a short time ago, we are now exactly 3 weeks away from the election. One of South Africa's top brand commentators is Tebe Akalafeng, who joins me now on the program. Tebe, how do you find or perceive a balance between shock value, which is obviously what this ad is trying to achieve, and also sensitivity in political advertising, particularly when it involves powerful imagery like flag burning?
Well, I think there are limits. I think, in this instance, the Democratic Alliance have exceeded those limits. I think I understand the idea of saying that let us put some shock value, let us disrupt the status quo, let us stand breakthrough. I understand all that. That's what we strive to do in advertising, in marketing. But you have to do that within a few things. You have to do it within the norms of the society. You have to do it within the laws of society. But also you have to do it within understanding the implications of this. I mean, if you look at this instance, you are now desecrating what should be the symbol of South Africans, not the symbol of the African National Congress or the EFF or the MK. And I think that's where they missed the boat.
So what do you think the impact of this could be, given the provocative imagery and what the impact might be on different segments of the electorate, considering, Tebby, as you've just pointed out, the emotional significance attached to a national symbol like the South African flag, and particularly in this country where we are only 30 years into a new democratic dispensation.
And particularly on this particular year when we are celebrating that which brought us together and the flag representing that. I think the impact to me, there's a couple of impacts. One is, first, you know, I think it's the United States or many other countries, you are not allowed to burn the flag. So there's a criminal impact, if you will. But then from a, let's look at the electorate now in terms of how they look at it. To the electorate, this perhaps deepens the narrative that, a growing narrative that the Democratic Alliance is perhaps aligned to one part of South Africa and not seeing themselves as part of the whole of South Africa. And that narrative has been growing steadily because of the many own goals that the Democratic Party has scored over the last couple of years.
Inevitably, Tebby Akalafeng, there's going to be backpedaling. The Democratic Alliance's explanation is that the visuals do not represent what they want to see happening in South Africa. In other words, they see this as a warning of a portent of the future. Does that argument hold any water, do you think?
No, it doesn't hold any water, because when it comes to any communication, nobody wants to, nobody when they're looking at a piece of communication, go to a dictionary, goes to an archive, go to Wikipedia to try and understand what it means. It is, first off, when the ad comes out, what is my immediate reaction? And the immediate reaction of many South Africans of all walks of life, I think even including some DA members for that matter, were looking at that piece of mark and says, but wait, who is burning the flag of the Republic of South Africa? Who is burning our flag? So no amount of explanation or walking back can explain the symbolism of the burning of the flag, because it looks like pure rebellion, it looks like pure rejection, and it looks like anti-South Africanism.
So when it comes to political advertising generally, then, how important or how powerful is visual imagery, and to what extent can that shape public opinion and influence voter behavior? Or is it better just to go with something which is maybe a little duller, but just focusing on data and policy?
No. Visual symbolism is very important when it comes to political campaigning. Because if you remember, a majority or many parts of the electorate cannot read or write. So they use symbolism or visual symbolism to identify which party is what and what the perhaps what that visual representation summarizes the party looks like. Let's look at a couple, for example. If you look at the EFF, in their campaign now. They're not really saying much on the campaign. They're just saying, vote EFF, 29 May 2024. What you see is red, and you see Julius Malema. And when you see that, you remember what they stand for, what they've done for the last 10 years. You know already they've been preaching land and nationalization. So there's a simplicity. When you see the visual of red, green, and gold, you know that black, gold, and green, you know that's the African National Congress. So irrespective of what you see, when you see them, you see Cyril Ramaphosa, it comes with it as well, what people hold and believe the ANC stands for. So irrespective of the words they could have written on the poster themselves, as it is, they've written, what, together let's do more of what we've done in the past. And you look at Action FA Green. So visual color, visual cue is very important when it comes to political branding. You can't just rely on the fact that people can read or write, especially as has been proven in the recent past, that even in South Africa, people can read, but they don't understand what they're reading.
Tebby Akalafeng, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Well, let's pivot now from politics to the economy, and the rising cost of living as well as high interest rates are challenging consumers every single day to seek out alternative ways of buying homes. For instance, First National Bank now has a value proposition that allows up to 12 people to buy a home collectively. I want to explore that in a little bit more detail and look at the efficacy of something like this. And I'm in conversation with Louis Barnard, who is founder of localmoney.co.za. He himself is a property investor. And Louis, first of all, maybe a little bit of context. How tough is it right now, in your opinion, that is forcing people to look at this option of collective home buying?
Okay, so at the moment, what we're seeing is that we've got fairly high interest rates. We see that many times salaries doesn't actually keep up with inflation, and homes are extremely expensive. So it's a bit of a difficult one for people to break into the property market at the moment, and therefore they're really looking for alternative ways of how they can invest.
So this collective home buying concept, I want to talk about how it works and the mechanics in just a moment, but who would it typically be aimed at?
Basically, what I've found is that, well, it's a lot of different people. In the context where I started, starting out as somebody who wants to invest, I couldn't afford it. So what I did is I bought a property with my dad and my sister at the time. But what I've seen as well is there's a big uptake for many people that cannot afford it. So we're looking at lower income groups where they want to basically come together and buy a property as a group.
The success of a concept like this, though, is obviously predicated on how well you get on with the other people. Whether it's friends or family, there's always huge risk attached.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think any investment does have risk, but because this is such a big investment, it's not just 10 or 20 rand that you're investing. You definitely do need to know the people. There are ways, obviously, such as exit clauses, having contracts and things in place. However, if you don't like the people or people go and, as they say, backstab you, can't pay the shortfall or something in, it does create a very big problem. That is true.
So how do you then set the rules of engagement in place?
Okay, so I think there's a very big important thing, and that is everybody needs to bring something to the table. So I've seen partnerships where somebody is very good at maintenance and a handyman. So they buy a property, somebody else provides the cash, and then that person then fixes it up so that they can either flip it or they can fix it and then rent it out. So the important thing is that what is everybody going to bring to the table? Is it that everybody's going to split the amount of cash for the shortfall? Who's going to pay the levies? All of those things. Once you've fleshed out those things, I think then you've got a very, very good foundation. I think it's also extremely important to have a contract in place between all the parties. I've also seen people starting a company, a Pty Limited. However, I think that's a little bit expensive. So within that contract is firstly then what does everybody bring to the table, and extremely, extremely important is what happens if this goes south? What happens if somebody can't pay? Are we going to be able to let somebody buy you out? How is the value determined? All of those things need to be captured in a contract.
So how do you do that, and what makes a good contract in this respect, given that dispute is inevitable when it comes to a big ticket item like this?
Look, I mean, ideally, you do want to not have a dispute. So oftentimes, I think it might be worth having a lawyer involved, especially if you don't know the people extremely well. However, in my case, it was very convenient as it was family and I knew the people really well. So we didn't have to go to the full extent of that. However, like I said, if it is a loose relationship, such as a friend that you haven't known for 20 or 30 years, I really recommend just chatting to a lawyer and somebody that understands these things.
So, Louis, First National Bank has this value proposition now that allows up to 12 people to buy a home collectively. Who do you think that is aimed at, and where do you think the potential risks are in that respect?
Okay, so personally, I think that is definitely for your low-income earners. And again, we've seen that, especially with a massive uptake, well, a massive influx of investors in your much more non-affluent areas, such as your Kasi, your more township areas. And so what's happening there is that a lot of people do want to get into the property market there. And it is extremely lucrative. You know, we're seeing things like people, building back rooms and renting it out for a fortune compared to the property value. So in the same sense, you'll get those people that says, listen, we want to buy a property that we can have a couple of rooms, rent them out. And especially, you can have then just disposable income. If you can think 12 households having disposable income of, if that would be 500 Rand, you're looking at 6,000 Rand a month that they can buy, spend towards a bond.
Do you think that banks have an appetite for this, given that there is inherent risk?
Look, I mean, everything does come with risk. And I think that is, if you're looking at banks offering a product like this, there must be some money to be made there. We also know that a lot of the, in my opinion, that we're finding that the banks and a lot of companies are expanding into economies and areas that wouldn't always have been expanded into, specifically because they see potential there so that they can make more money.
Louis Barnard, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally, the Eastern Cape is becoming ready to be the next cannabis capital of the country following a R1 billion investment for the next 5 years. This is going to result in the processing of cannabis into various medicinal products and oils, and I read could create something in the region of 30,000 jobs. More now from the Small Business Minister, Stella Ndebeni Abrams. Minister, welcome to you and thank you very much for talking to me. What then are the primary objectives of this investment?
Well, firstly, the investment is to appreciate that the province can really grow economically when they invest in cannabis. You will recall that most of the cannabis is found in this province, especially in Bondoland. Now, to look at industrialized areas wherein we allow investors to come in and put in money so that there could be processing, we see that as an opportunity to help the people of Eastern Cape benefit from that, whilst they will also be assisting in terms of the actual products that will be produced through the investment.
Minister, are you able to break down for me then the types of jobs expected to be created and perhaps more importantly, the skills necessary for those positions?
Well, the first thing I must say as I look first on the interest of the SMMEs and cooperatives that I'm responsible for, we have been assured that the investment will enable the small-scale farmers, especially those with hemp permits and those that have land between 5 to 10 hectares, they will be contracted in order to grow the medicinal cannabis flower for MediGrow, the company that is investing. And that's a huge opportunity because we're talking about lots and lots of small-scale farmers that are already involved in this work that we're talking about. But also, you will recall, Remy, that most of the time when we get SMMEs contracted, they normally underpaid, but the company has assured that the payment will be the one that is market-related for whatever they produce. That's the first thing. The second thing is ensuring that the farmers will be trained on all aspects of primary production, which complies to good agricultural practice. Again, if you're looking at the agricultural sector and the contribution that it makes in relation to jobs that are created, we're talking about massive numbers. I may not be able to quantify those numbers now, because firstly, we must get the small-scale farmers. How many are they? Those that have the land size that I spoke about. And then once that happens, then we're able to say, if we have 10, 15, this is what it translates into. It doesn't need people who are highly skilled first, as they'll be focusing on planting and everything else, but it does need others that are qualified when it comes to the processing elements of it. Like you must make sure that you have the people that are going to test the product. You must make sure that you have people, that means the laboratory. Then you must have people that you know that now they are pharmaceuticals that must be able to process and make sure that it is relevant for medicinal use. Mm. So there's different skills that will be required.
And critical, Minister, in the early stages, with a focus, as you've pointed out to me, on medicinal products and oils, that measures are implemented immediately to ensure the quality and safety of these products. No doubt you're giving a lot of thought to that.
Definitely, we've done that, which is why we are not only looking at what the Eastern Cape does. We've come on board as the portfolio. We've roped in the Department of Agriculture and Health to make sure that all the critical stakeholders are able to give effect to whatever that will be required. And therefore, there are no delays in the output that is expected.
How is Government Minister planning to position then the Eastern Cape's cannabis products, both domestically and internationally? There has to be a concerted drive to make sure that you hit the markets correctly.
There is a concerted drive already. I'm sure you have heard President Ramaphosa when he outlines what is it that we're looking to benefit from this cannabis. And the first thing, as I said, is to look at the master plan as developed by the Minister of DTIC that looks into what is it that we're going to do, which links the domestic producers to the international market. That's what I'm saying. The investment by MediGrow enables these local producers, amongst others, because already the people of this province are trading outside. If you go to Australia, if you go to certain countries, they will tell you that they source the cannabis directly from the Eastern Cape. It's just that it has not been processed. We have not been, it was taken raw. And now it's an opportunity to say, now we can also process and supply other people, which leads to the first question that you asked in relation to the jobs that will be created in the process. So we are looking at positioning Eastern Cape as the best province, working with KwaZulu-Natal, which is also great in producing hemp and cannabis. So we are looking at that master plan that must really position the two provinces to be the main suppliers of the cannabis-related products.
And let me just ask you a final question then. Looking beyond the initial 5 years, what kind of long-term goals for the industry are being set, particularly in the Eastern Cape, but also KZN, and the investment that we referred to initially? How does it facilitate those goals?
The long-term goal, as I said, is to make sure that the Eastern Cape becomes the hub of producing the cannabis-related products. And what now they are working on is the issue of addressing the logistics, which seems also as a challenge. So they are busy engaging as the province, engaging Transnet and the other critical stakeholders. You have seen the Minister of Transport through SANRAL are rolling out roads in order to make sure that there could be movement of the goods. Minister Zikalala is busy with the small harbours, again, to enable the transportation of the products that are produced here. They have also made sure that we put incubators wherein we can now help all those villagers that are farming, you know, especially if you go to Mbondoland, most people have been relying on planting cannabis, although it was illegal. Now to help them to be incubated, we have the University of Walter Sisulu, which has already been approved or accredited as a university that must do research. So which means we are really looking at a situation whereby we look into more things that can be done with cannabis, and also what other areas that can be licensed in the value chain of the cannabis.
I am going to leave it there, Minister Ndebeni Abrahams. Thank you very much indeed. And that issue also informs our online poll today. South Africa's cannabis economy, do you think it has huge potential? Is it risky, or that regulation is absolutely critical? If you have a view on that, I would like to hear from you. Please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.